RNN.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means.
Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel.
Tonight's featured show is Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. Welcome to the Republic News Network for our live national broadcast. You may call me Kelby, and tonight I'm going to be acting as your moderator. The RNN, which stands for the Republic News Network, has been doing this radio show since 2010, and it's always been a friendly introduction for the people of the United States Corporation. Here we go. It's true. The United States is a federal corporation, and their exclusive jurisdiction is in the District of Columbia. The Republic government was simply a bunch of U.S. citizens that in law don't have access to the Bill of Rights, and they realized they wanted to be Americans as our founders and our law provided each and every one of us. See, we've been hard at work since 2008, and since 2010, we have successfully re-inhabited the original government vacated under Lincoln in 1861. I know, it's hard to understand. Don't worry. We are law-abiding, peaceful Americans and very pro-government, and we love our country. You can consider the Republic members are tired of the corruption that we see every day. See, we found in the law that there is two forms of government here on the land, and we did something about it. We are people. Mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, we have families just like you. We simply found some truths, and now we're sharing these important truths with the rest of the world. So get ready to hear things that sound amazing, and get ready to understand that you too are about to be a part of history. We welcome each one of you to Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel and your Republic, if you so choose. But before we go into our broadcast tonight, please bow your head in prayer.
Father God, once again, we want to thank you for the opportunity to just spread the truth, Lord. Bless this show, bless Dan and our guest Eric, and just guide them and protect them. We pray this in your son's name. Amen. Mr. Happel, I yield the floor.
Well, thank you, Kelby, and I welcome all of our listeners tonight to a broadcast with Eric Lawyer. Eric is he's the founder of Firefighters and Emergency Workers for 9/11 Truth. And Eric has been on our radio show before, but before he was on with Richard Gage and shared the time with Richard, and I felt like it was important that our listeners understand a little bit about the fire and emergency workers and how they are becoming enlightened and tuned in on what's been happening and what happened as the result of 9/11. I think most people on our listenership recognize that there were some things that happened on 9/11 that are very difficult to explain. And Eric, I welcome you to the show. I thank you for being on, and I really appreciate the fact that you started the organization you did to educate and to make the fire and emergency workers, let's say, more in tune with what has really happened as a result of 9/11. And it also creates a bit of a opportunity for our listeners to understand that your group is very, very patriotic. Your firefighters and your emergency workers and all of them really are very patriotic, and we need to support and help them in the battle to really bring our country back to what it should be. And so with that, Eric, would you like to give our listeners a little bit of information on yourself and a little background, and then how and why you formed the organization?
Thank you, Dan. Yeah, it's an honor to be here again. I always love being on your show. And so my name is Eric Lawyer. Like you said, my background, I spent 25 years in fire and emergency services and retired with a disability with an injury back in 2012 from Seattle Fire Department. And what brought me to start this was, like you said, I was a diehard patriot. And when 9/11 first happened, I went out there to Ground Zero to support, to attend funerals and to support the firefighters that were there, however we could. I was on a federal team at the time, we had two teams in Seattle, and I was on a team that was not called up. Our other team was, so we were more in a support, role that we did when we were out there. And so when I was out there, my focus was on, what the story I was sold in a way, the Muslim terrorists. And so I wanted to go to war and was very passionate about that. And then years later, what happened was it was a friend of mine who was actually a West Point graduate who was also a vice president of a major bank. And he and I lived close to each other. And he came over one night and was having a beer and said, if I didn't know better, and this was back in early 2008, he said, if I didn't know better, I would swear there are people trying to destroy our economy. And I said, what? And he explained to me that they as a bank were being ordered to do things that an Econ 101 student wouldn't do. And I wouldn't really listen to conspiracy stories and all that stuff before, but when he said it and knowing his background, I was like, wait a second. And that was what really my door opening, my red pill, I guess you'd call it. And so I started researching like crazy. And because someone wasn't shoving it down my throat, I was able to go back and look at the evidence actually from the Zacharias Moussaoui trial exhibits. And I started looking at that, like, what evidence do they have? And once I started looking at the actual fire evidence, I was underwhelmed, to say the least, but I realized this is not right, and saw the evidence, and I'd been in enough fires to know what it would actually look like, and realized that this is actually, we're being sold a bag of goods here. And so when I really realized what was happening, something inside me just kind of was a calling. Like I was almost in a panic. Like my entire worldview had just shattered in that moment. And I knew I had to do something and I had to stand up. And that was the moment, when I decided to found Firefighters for 9/11 Truth. And that was back in 2008. And since then, really it was operational with firefighters till 2010, end of 2010. And what I say I'm kind of doing now, I'm still tapped in and we still have, the site up as a reference site. And there's actually firefighters from other countries even that have really been supporting. And you can see, if your listeners can watch a movie we have on there called Calling Out Bravo 7, does a phenomenal job, I think, of kind of sharing from the firefighter's perspective what happened. But where I'm really focused now is on where do we go from here. So that's really, where my energy is right now. And the way I explain it to people is I see, like, by going deep into how corrupt everything is to the core. Like I really, and I can share more here in a second. I'll take a break in just a moment. But when I got to how corrupt everything was, I realized our country's on fire. It's burning. And so I started looking at this as a fire operation. If our country's burning, we have several operations that need to happen at the same time. One of them is we need to alert the people that their country is burning, that these structures are on fire. And that's what your show is doing. That was what I did for several years. And at the same time, we also have to have a foresight and go, where are we going from here? So in a fire operation, we don't just, if it's dangerous to pull people out right away, we don't do that. We do what's called protect in place. And I've been working with groups on how, once these things start collapsing even more, where do we go? Because if we don't have a safety net or something to land in, this could be really catastrophic.
Well, and I appreciate exactly how you came into the understanding that 9/11 wasn't quite what it appeared to be. And I know that you've teamed up with Richard Gage and you've done a video together, and you've also gotten a lot of additional information. But one of the things that has to stand out to you is the way they destroyed the forensic evidence, the fire damage in the structure itself, how quickly they tried to get rid of the evidence and dispose of it and literally send it in massive ships over to China to be recycled. Tell us a little bit about what a normal fire forensic operation to determine the cause of a fire or collapse and how that varied so much from what actually happened at Ground Zero.
Perfect. Yeah. So like I mentioned, I was out there in the week following and I saw those trucks leaving, you know, rapidly. And at the time I accepted it because it was a rescue and recovery operation still. You know, at that point they realized there's probably nobody still alive, but it was a recovery operation and you have to remove debris and all that to be able to do that. So I just dismissed it as that. I didn't realize what was happening was that evidence was being shipped off and destroyed. And so that was one of the things I looked at when I looked at the evidence myself, and I went, wait, we have what's called the NFPA, the National Fire Protection Association, and they kind of set the standards for the fire service on how we, you know, fight high-rise fires, how we, you know, how we staff, how we do everything, basically. There's a national standard on, and there's also a national standard on fire investigation, and it's called NFPA 921. And it's actually the national standard for fire and explosion investigation. So it's not just fire, but it's fire and explosion. And so I pulled that out, and I actually went to our, you know, fire department library and pulled out the one for 2001 and realized, like, okay, this is the manual. It's not, you know, it's not law. They don't have to follow everything exactly. It's a guidebook. But I talked to several senior investigators and asked them how, you know, like, how do you, how is this really used for those who understand this? And he said the 921 is actually for those departments that don't have their full on their own arson investigation team. It's more like a very basic manual. So he said, in our department, we don't follow it. We go far beyond it. So this isn't like, this is the basics and we go way beyond those. So to put this in perspective, on a routine house fire, you know, we're taught from the fire academy from day one, basically, or, you know, before we even go into operations, we're taught that first, you know, first job is rescue and recovery. Second job is maintaining that evidence for the investigation. So even though that stuff was being shipped off, it should have been maintained. And there's actually sections in NFPA and there's federal evidence laws. So by destroying that evidence before the investigation even began was a federal crime. And, you know, there's been no accounting for that.
Okay. So I want to understand this completely. When they cleared out the evidence out of there without any real investigation into it at all, that actually was a federal crime?
Yeah, there's laws of evidence. So destruction of evidence is a crime. So that's what happened. And, you know, in addition to that, so that evidence was destroyed. And the reason why that's so important is, I mean, if we take even the loss of life, you know, take that out of the picture, this was the first time three concrete and steel high-rise structures had ever collapsed due to fire. First time and last time. It's only those three towers have ever done that, complete collapses from this. So this was our one opportunity to learn from that. So even if we take away the whole crime of 9/11, but just from building safety, they've destroyed that possibility to even, you know, to understand how Tower 7 collapsed because of that.
Right.
Well, that was Tower 7 that was destroyed that I'm talking about. A lot of the Tower 1 and 2 was destroyed, but pretty much all of Tower 7, and NIST admits that you know, it was destroyed.
Well, and it was destroyed, and it didn't have any kind of a hit by any aircraft, and it had very limited office fires. And I've had several people say, well, that couldn't have been, those fires must have been much more catastrophic than you could see from the films. But Eric, you were there. You talked to the firefighters there. What did they have to say about the fact that Building 7 collapsed the way that it did? And incidentally, I want our listeners to understand, Building 7 was a 47-story high-rise structure that housed a number of different agencies, and some of them were federal agencies, including the FBI and CIA. So Eric, what did the firefighters that you talked to and have spoken to since that event, what did they say about the extent of the fires and the damage to Building 7?
That's a great question, and I'm going to give you a psychology answer almost. So there's almost three phases I've noticed people are in, and this includes firefighters. And I was in this state myself. Is like, you've heard of Stockholm Syndrome, right? Where, have you heard of that before, Dan?
Oh, yeah, you bet.
So Stockholm Syndrome, for those of your listeners don't know, was a bank robbery in Stockholm. What ended up happening was the people that were hostages ended up defending their hostage takers. So it's almost like because their life is in danger and they realize that, you know, the one who is protecting them, they form this bond. I feel like our country and a lot of the fire service is like in a Stockholm Syndrome state. We know at some level something's not right, but we're in that state. And when I was in that state, what I did was I created an alternative story. I took what I was fed, and I would find reasons why this doesn't make sense, or that this does make sense. And so I've talked to really three different groups of firefighters. Some that are vehement that, oh yeah, that was burning. It was, you know, very clear that it, you know, it was heavy fire and we were withdrawn. We weren't able to continue the firefight. So it was expected. And that was because the other two towers had already come down. So they're thinking, oh, this one's going to too. I've talked to other ones that were like, that didn't make sense from day one, but they don't want to go any deeper. Then I've talked to other ones that are very clear that there was not heavy fire here. Like, we've been on fires with way more fire, you know, fire load than this, and those buildings didn't collapse. So, and they heard the explosions, you know, that there's so much evidence and witness testimony of explosions. And that wasn't even tested for. So that in the NFPA, it's called for in multiple sections, that when you have the type of damage that all three of these buildings had, there should have been a test for explosives. So it's that range. It's full denial to all the way to it's a cover-up and there were explosions or explosives in the building. We know it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, with that, I have to say, too, that the understanding that I've gotten from you is that more and more of the firefighters that you know and that you've worked with are really starting to come to the conclusion that the collapses really didn't happen anything like they said they did. There's quite a large contingent now that understand there's more to the story.
Yeah, there are a lot more that understand, and it's spreading. It's still not okay in the culture of the fire service, though, to really bring it into the firehouse. And that's what the challenge, because it was such a shock to what we call the brotherhood and so traumatic. And to bring in, like, this is what I got a lot from, especially from FDNY guys and several others. I was not a very popular guy, to say the least, in the fire service from 2008 to 2010 or so because of the work I was doing with this. But what I would hear a lot is of guys that were inside FDNY's firehouse or houses that did believe what, you know, that did understand what was happening. If they tried to question or bring it up in the firehouse, they would immediately be shut down. And it was because what was perceived and what I was told was it's disrespectful to the brotherhood, because they looked at it as they died from these terrorists. Now our military is going to solve the problem. And so if we change that in any way, if that appeared to be not the case, it was dishonoring them. So it was really this cultural, you know, gag that really made it tough to talk about it. And so now more becoming comfortable talking about it, but it's usually not, you know, it's not the norm. So it's spreading, but there's still like this tipping point that's coming.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And incidentally, a friend of mine has been contacted by Deborah Burlingame, who her husband was one of the pilots and on 9/11. And she lost her husband on 9/11, and she is also one of the people that are questioning the government story or the traditional story of what happened on 9/11. And I may at some point get her on with you and Richard and see if we can have that additional insight by someone who actually, you know, her husband was very directly involved in 9/11, and, you know, she lost him as a result of that. So Anyway, yeah, there's it's quite an interesting group of people that are starting to question exactly what happened on 9/11. And according to the most recent polls I've seen, over half of the country really question if the official version is exactly, you know, what really happened. So anyway, Eric, I want you to kind of talk about the NIST study or paper that was done, and also some of your investigation and some of the research you've done, and how all that kind of it kind of brings a new light to the whole process of investigation that happened.
Yes, thanks. For your listeners that don't know NIST, NIST is the National Institute on Standards and Technology. So it's a national institute on standards, so like national standards. So I always, the irony is here's the institute that sets national standards, and they didn't follow the national standards. So they were tasked with the investigation, which was not normal. It's not normal for NIST to be the lead investigators on something like this, but for political reasons, they were tasked with this. And it was years later, after the collapses, that they really started the investigation into Tower 7. And I always focus on Tower 7. There's overwhelming evidence for all three towers. The fact that, there were over 100, I forget the exact number, but it's over 120 first responders that reported explosions. There's audio recordings of explosions. There's videos of explosions. I mean, there's the evidence of explosives being used is overwhelming. And what I really focused on when I first started the work with, Fire Fresh and 11 Truth was all the NFPA standards that talked about when you test for explosives. And there's several sections. I'll just name a few. It's like high order damage, which means when you have buildings explode into pieces like we saw, that's considered high order damage. That explosives must be tested for then. When you, one's called analyzed fuel source, and what that means, it's NFPA 921.18.15. And what that gets into is when the investigator is to basically look at the damage they see, and they have to rule out they have to rule out what fuel sources could have caused that. And that means could jet fuel have caused this? You have to look at these things. And if they can't, they have to eliminate all fuel sources to identify one that can. But the one that really got my attention, and I didn't realize, I was never trained, this in the academy or anything in my classes after that, I didn't realize there was an actual NFPA standard, national standards, 19.2.4, and it's called exotic accelerants. And this to me was the smoking gun, because it talks specifically about the damage we saw at all three towers. And what it talks about is if you see melted steel or concrete, and the investigators, there are several videos on this that point out, they called them meteorites, and there was quite a bit of melted steel and concrete. And for concrete to melt, that's an extremely high temperature. And so there has been histories of this in the past, and what they found was it was thermite mixtures that caused it. So the manual talks specifically about thermite. So it's like it couldn't have made it any easier for the investigators to go, oh, wow, here it is right here. It points to the exact evidence we saw, and it says thermite. So why don't we test for thermite? Well, to this day, NIST has refused, and any basically government-funded agency has refused to test. There have been private people that have tested and found it, but that's kind of the essence of, what was missed here.
Mm-hmm. And the NFPA standards that you refer to, they're real specific in the way you approach a forensic investigation of a fire. And, you talked a little bit about it earlier, but those procedures are pretty well-defined and pretty rigid, aren't they? One leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, and they don't leave a lot of areas that I guess are unexplained. They have a logical sequence that they normally follow, and those things were really not done on the Twin Towers or Building 7, correct?
Correct. Yeah, the major sections that would have guided this investigation were all completely ignored. There's not one that I can say was followed, and it's not even a conspiracy theory. It's NIST themselves admits it. So they admit that they did not test for explosives, which is, you know, in contradiction to what the standards say. They admit the evidence was destroyed before they started the investigation. So, I mean, it's not conspiracy. It's fact. And they're like everything in the fire service is very structured. And it's also part of the culture. You know, when we show up at a house fire and we get that house fire out, until the investigator team is there, we are responsible. We are the investigator. So we're always, you know, combing, kind of looking ourselves where we think that, you know, source of the fire, and the more years you have in, the better you get at identifying, you know, what the cause of the fire could have been, even before the investigators get there. And a lot of the times, you know, we get it right. Sometimes we don't. And, but what we're there for is, even as firefighters, we understand we protect that scene until the investigation is complete. And what that means is, even a homeowner who, nobody was hurt in the fire, we won't let the homeowner back into the home without one of us being with them. So we'll let them go back in if they want to get something out, but we're going to be there with them to make sure they don't destroy or remove any evidence. So for this to be completely destroyed is, you know, beyond irresponsible.
Well, it really is, yes, and certainly it would, from a professional like you, it would really stand out as being, very, very suspicious. So tell me, when did you meet Richard Gage, and how have you been working with Richard to try to expose some of this?
Sure. So when I had that awakening I told you about, when my buddy from West Point came over, when I kind of jump into something, I go all in. It's like, I joke, sometimes it's a blessing, sometimes it's a curse. But I went all in. And so I was almost, for 48 hours, I probably had 6 hours of sleep, but I was researching like crazy. And I found Richard's work in that first 48 hours. And it turned out that he was actually coming up to Canada, Vancouver, and I was in Seattle. He was coming up to Vancouver like 4 days after that. So I was able to connect with him almost immediately and let him know, you know, what I was thinking and that. And he helped connect me to some people pretty quickly. And that's really what helped ground Firefighters for 9/11 Truth. And after I started Firefighters, I had never done a website. I didn't know what I was doing, to be honest, at all. And still don't know what I'm doing a lot of times, but I keep moving forward. And I didn't know what I was doing. And so I didn't know, like, what I was allowed to put on the website or that, or, you know, I didn't know the implications of what I was going to be posting would have. And thank goodness there is this man named Colonel George Nelson, and he was an Air Force crash investigator. And he had reached out to me. So when I read his article, once I read that, I went, how can anybody question what he's writing here? Because this was what he did. Mm-hmm. And if your listeners haven't seen it, just Google Colonel George Nelson. It's called Anatomy of I forget what it's called, something about a crash investigation. And he talks about what should have happened from the military's, you know, investigation standpoint. But he called me at the station and at the firehouse, and I was a little bit like, uh-oh, I maybe have stepped on some toes, because I, you know, posted his article without asking him. And he's like, oh, no, that's great. That's why I put it out there. He said, but I'm reaching out because I want you to understand, you just opened a door into a world you don't understand. And if you're not careful, you're going to get yourself in a lot of trouble or worse. And so he then said, I'm willing to connect you to some intelligence officers, some high-ranking military intelligence that are on our side, you know, that want to expose this too, but they're going to help you understand how the shadow government works and kind of where to go from here. And that was really kind of that's really what helped guide a lot of where I went. And it was really empowering to understand how the game worked before I got too deep into it.
Well, I don't want to expose anyone that you don't want exposed, but frankly, I'd like to hear what those national intelligence people told you. We've had some on our radio show, and they've been very forthright and very, very honest about the events, and not necessarily just 9/11, but in general. What did the folks in the intelligence that you talked to, what did they tell you?
Yeah, the one I developed the deepest relationship with, that's the one, George Nelson, who's actually now passed away. He let me know. He said, I trust this guy with my granddaughters. And he said he knows the backstory and he understands what's happening more than anyone I've ever met. So I reached out to him and we ended up developing a relationship that lasted for about a year and a half, 2 years, where I would, you know, he would kind of be my, quote, intelligence officer in a way and help me see things that were happening. But what he shared, just in a nutshell, was that he said, I started doing what I was doing because I believed in America and I was a patriot. And it was pretty early on. He said, it took a few years, but he said, I'm not proud of what I did. But he said, one of the things I did was I was the guy that would figure out pressure points on people, that we needed to make do something. And he said, I was doing it with foreign countries initially, you know, that type of thing. And he said, it wasn't until I started realizing what the game was. And the more he started, you know, he was older. And so he started back during the Cold War. And he said, the more I learned, the more I realized I wasn't working for the American people. I was working for private corporations. And so he basically just shared kind of that this shadow government. He's like, First of all, he said, I want you to slow down. It didn't start with 9/11. Shadow governments have been in existence since the beginning of governments. It's just the way they operate. He said part of the problem is the American people have fallen asleep at the wheel, and we've allowed this government to get too much power. So the bigger the government, the bigger the shadow. And so he just started explaining, the history and how the bankers, and he calls them the banksters, how they basically funded war since the beginning. And he, I can get into more detail if you want, but it's basically from a more of a spy novel kind of thing, he helped me, he said, he said, founding firefighters should not live in truth. He said, you might become a point of contact for people that have some pretty, incriminating evidence. And he said, I want you to understand something. If you take that evidence, if it's something that could expose at a level that they don't want to be exposed at, he said, you can put yourself in serious danger. So he explained how to create a dead man switch. And I don't know if you know what that is, but for your listeners, you might not know. It's basically
Go ahead and explain that. I'd like to have a better explanation.
Yeah, and there's actually quite a few people I know that are on the inside that have these set. So it's basically, if you have evidence that could bring down the powers that be that doesn't want to be exposed, if you go forward with it, like we've seen whistleblowers start to do, and they end up dead. And so before you ever would mention to anyone that you have this evidence, you would have to have key trusted sources in multiple locations. You would have this basically collection of evidence that you would have in multiple locations, and the understanding would be, and that's why he said it has to be people you really, really trust, like at a life level. And if something were to happen to you, then it would be released. So that, and he said, once you've set that, then you make it very clear, because
Eric?
Yeah, I see him still on the board.
Oh.
He's still there. Eric, you muted out.
Okay. We'll need to get him back on. All righty. He may not realize he's muted.
That's what I'm thinking. Shoot him a quick text.
Okay.
He's probably just knocking away. Hold on one sec.
Okay.
Just waiting for him now.
Okay, good. Well, I mean, take this opportunity while we're waiting for Eric to get back on. You take this opportunity to tell our listeners of I was approached yesterday by someone extremely reliable in national security, and someone who has had an absolutely impeccable record of accuracy, and who is, let's say, connected with the absolute highest levels of national security. And I was informed that the so-called false alarm in Hawaii was not a false alarm at all, but was in fact a missile attack that was stopped by our anti-missile defense system, and that that missile was launched from a Chinese submarine that belonged to a rogue, let's say a rogue element, or was being captained by a rogue element of the Chinese communist military, and that in fact it was shot down by American anti-ballistic missile system, and then the Chinese Navy actually went out and apparently sunk the submarine that had launched that missile. That's how close we were, and the fact is that you know, we were told it was just a false alarm. I was also informed that the so-called false alarm could not possibly have happened because the sequence of keyed announcements that have to go into something like that require like six steps. And that it couldn't possibly happen that one, you know, a guy hit the wrong button and ended up with that warning of an incoming missile. I've also been told that there are many dozens of witnesses who were either on fishing boats or on tourist boats off the Hawaiian coast that saw what they thought was a meteor coming in, and then they saw a large explosion, you know, as that meteor was way up in the atmosphere. And so, yeah, isn't that incredible? And I have been told there are two elements of the Chinese communist government. There is a very pro, let's say, pro-Western, pro-Trump, pro-premier, Chinese premier government, that there's a group that's like that, and there are also a rogue group of hardcore communist Chinese in the military who are adamantly opposed to that. And so all I can say is that I think over a period of time, we are going to try to have some one of the top military people in the country come on and talk about this event. Someone who is very credible and very reliable. And so I thought I'd mention that because that is just absolutely mind-boggling that an event like that could have happened and come so close to literally creating, you know, creating war. Starting the Third World War, and the fact that it was stopped is incredible and great, but the fact that it could have happened in the first place is even more amazing. So, Eric, are you back
Eric
on?
Eric has, yes, he has. He's joined us once again.
I am good. Thanks, Dan.
All right. Well, we lost you when you were kind of explaining how you've got to have your material sourced in a number of different places where if they get rid of you, that material is still going to be scattered all over the place.
Right, right. They can't get rid of the whatever's being revealed by getting rid of you. So that's kind
right.
of the essence of it. And the other thing, I'd love to go into kind of where to go from here, and he planted that seed in me originally because I started, you know, realizing like, wow, and I know you get this too, like this corruption just is pervasive. It's everywhere. And I said, you know, how do we win? And I looked at it as an us versus them. And he was really clear with me in the beginning, like, this isn't just them. Like, this is in all of us, this shadow. Like, if we ignore it, it just is going to grow. And he said, what we have to do is we keep shining the light, and we come from a place of love. He's like, when we come from that place of attack and us versus them, that's what the system is designed for. So he's like, it knows how to basically silence anyone that's fighting it. So that's where, you know, that kind of planted that seed in me, like, you know, it has to almost be like what I thought originally was, we need a revolution, you know, and in a revolution, everybody loses. I mean, that would be, you know, unbelievable and unacceptable route. And so I was looking at that route, and he helped me see that it's not that, you know, it's something else. And he said, I want you to remember something. He said, when it's finally exposed, who really did it? He said, it's not just those individuals, but it's all of us who've empowered this system that has allowed mm-hmm. this to happen. So it's all of us. And he said, right. when that time comes where people are being outed and arrested and all that, because he said it will come. You know, there's enough insiders with evidence that are waiting for the right time to release it when it's safe for them to do. He said, it will come. And he said, if it's off with their heads, we're going to have the same system we have. They're going to see it as it was individuals that were bad, and so therefore they need to be removed. And once they're removed, somehow we're going to go back to everything's okay. He said, if we pause and we see there is another way, and we begin to see it as a systems problem, like we changed the system. It wasn't that people mm-hmm. were bad. There were bad people, but I don't want to say bad people. I don't believe in that anymore. It's we do bad things based on the culture and environment and everything else we're in. So if we change that system, he said, that will be the opportunity where we can start again. And he's like, then humanity has a chance. So it's like, he said, be very careful in how you're approaching this, you know, because you're going to get back whatever you put out. So that mm-hmm. really kind of guided me from the beginning of not coming from that place of revolution and that, but looking for, you know, where do we go from here?
You know, that's amazing. I'm really pleased to hear that that gentleman had that knowledge, that understanding, and that attitude, because in truth, the only way we will ever win this battle is by educating and getting people to understand, and then finding solutions that are good solutions, permanent solutions that will end this kind of corruption. And, you know, we need to recognize who's responsible, but we also need to recognize that we are all individually part of the game. And V.I. Lenin referred to the people that helped with establish communism in the Soviet Union. He referred to them as useful idiots. And we've got an awful lot of useful idiots literally in the whole world, but certainly in our own country.
Yes, that's what really inspires me, is that, you know, that hope, that solution. And that's what I've really spent the last 6 years now, since 2011, that's where my, or almost 7 years, I guess it is, yeah, that's where my focus has been. And, so I look at it as, you know, when I bring it into fire metaphor, people, you know, people seem to get it. So if we look at, you know, the fire service, we have operations, which are the ones who put out fires. And so we would say, you know, if we are showing up and we have to put out these fires, we as a system, as a culture, you know, as a service, have failed, because we have other ways to do that, as, you know, prevention and new building construction and all that, that is there to prevent these fires. So if we look at this as our country, as a system that's been co-opted, hijacked, whatever you want to call it, I love how you open your show with the American corporation, because most people don't even realize that. So we're not even dealing with the, you know, the structure that we all thought we were in, but that structure is burning and we still are giving our power to it. So that's where, you know, I'd love to hear your perspective on this too. And I have some ideas, but when we empower, like when we go through the system that is designed to keep the, you know, that we were never really had a say in because it's a private corporation, when we empower that system and play in their game, we're giving that system power. So it's almost like we're enslaving ourselves without even knowing it.
Right, right. And I think a lot of G. Edward Griffin refers to it. He says, these people are scientists. These people that have established the system that we live under are not people that have just willy-nilly done things and it just turned out this way. They have planned this from day one, and the fact is the only way we're going to solve the issues that we have, and you're right, we have to have the Christian attitude. We have to be doing it because we love this country, because we love humanity, because we want to protect the rights of individuals, and we want to protect the Constitution and the things that are so special that have allowed the United States of America to really flourish. And in spite of the cancer that's eating us from within, we still have the ability to do that if we just go back to what the founders really intended with this country. And we've got to do it in a way that we don't allow them to trigger an event that's going to cause catastrophic loss of life. Because in reality, and I do a program on UN Agenda 21 all over the country, but in reality, and they've stated it right in their own documents, they don't believe that the world's population is sustainable at over a billion people. So they plan on getting rid of 6 billion people. And frankly, they don't care how it happens. They just want to reduce the amount of people in the world because they see us as the problem and not the solution.
Right. Yeah, and that's a hard one for people to swallow sometimes, but the evidence for that is, you know, pretty overwhelming also. And yeah, and when you said a couple things. One of them before was the game, and that's, you know, it's like there's a game that was created that we didn't understand the rules to. We thought we were told a set of rules, and that really wasn't the rules. And now that we're beginning to learn, we're going, wait a second, we don't like this game. So it's an opportunity for the American people to really own up to what's happened. And I know for me, it was like I felt like I'd been duped. And so that's a hard thing sometimes to go, wow, I really was naive and I was duped. But then to go through that transformation of going, I want to destroy something and, you know, punish whoever did this. Like, for me, it was like that's where I was. I wanted to punish whoever did this. And where I'm at now is I think the American people are going to have an incredible opportunity because as more of this is exposed and it comes times for trials, if we look, you know, you taking the Bible as a reference, you know, the Jesus' Sermon on the Mount talked about it's no longer an eye for an eye, you know, and loving kindness. But what people don't understand is we are still using a justice system. It's called punitive justice. We are still using a justice system that's based on an eye for an eye. It's punitive stands for proportional revenge. Mm-hmm. So if we look at that, like that's a place, that's an acupuncture point, I'd call it, or a pressure point, where we could start looking at, you know, this is where I'm talking about where to go from here. We need to have a real understanding that there will come a time where there will be a day of reckoning. And how are we going to apply justice? Is it going to be an eye for an eye? Or is it going to be loving kindness in a new way? And that's where, you know, one of the areas where I get really lit up because I now have been exposed to, there's a lot of people that what I didn't see this when I was stuck in all the corruption and just focusing on that, what I didn't see was all these things, justice, economics, healthcare, all these elements. There have been groups working on new kind of I'd call enlightened or, you know, really advanced solutions for a long time. And there are a lot of these are really grounding. But to come together as a whole model, it's going to need a group of people that say, yes, we'll plant that flag and we're willing to, you know, to adapt these new ways or at least test them. And that's where, you know, my interest goes is how, you know, asking that question. If we, you know, if it was to be exposed tomorrow, how are we going to do this? Are we going to use the very system that they have created that has been created by a shadow element? Because if we do, I guarantee you, we're not going to get to the root of really what was the cause, and that would be the systemic cause and those really behind, you know, just like Nuremberg, the true perpetrators there were never exposed or never held accountable. So we're probably never really going to get the kind of justice we all think we want. But what if we have the opportunity to see justice in a new way where it really highlights and brings people together and helps us step into creating a better system with what we've learned from this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree with that. I do have to say, though, I think we do need to make sure that we make the perpetrators of the worst of the worst, we need to make sure that these people are accountable. And, you know, that may be, that may mean that, you know, they face lifelong prison. They may be executed. I don't know what that is, but I do know that the solution to making our world a lot better place has, as you say, nothing to do with punitive measures. We need to start working together, and we need to do it in a way that obviously we believe in individualism, we believe in a constitutional system, we believe in the rights of the individual and the rights of property and all these things that have made this country great. We need to make sure that we allow that blessing to continue and that we expand on it, because it was a very successful model before it was co-opted.
Right, right. And that's part of that too, was it was more locally empowered. The co-option,
exactly,
you know, centralized everything. And so that's part of that inverting. So where, you know, what the work I'm doing now, one of the projects we're working on is called One Corps. So, you know, the Peace Corps, but One Corps would be self-funding in a private, basically a private unified service. And so looking at, okay, why do we need government in the first place? And it's really when people aren't responsible and don't work together as a community, or, you know, are destroying or whatever, somebody needs to step in. So how do we really start creating local models that could provide those services, but not from a tax base? And so that's the groups I'm working with now have some really inspiring solutions to this. And that's where I see this blending beautifully with, you know, kind of taking back the original, the essence of the Founding Fathers and the original framework, where it was more local and state, you know, at a local state level. And the federal government is there just to basically support and make things interoperate a little bit more easy, but they're not the ones, you know,
absolutely,
the ones controlling it.
It was always intended to be a bottom-up government, and people don't realize that the number one sovereign in our country, the very most important element of our country, is the individual. And from the individual, then that flows into local government, and local government flows into state government. And the federal government was created only to be a protector of the Constitution. It was only intended to be a protector of the rights of the individuals, and government was to protect, not to provide. And that whole thought process has been set on its head and destroyed over the last 120 years. And we need to go back to a model where individuals, the rights of individuals are protected, and individuals have the kind of personal freedom, as long as they don't infringe on the rights of others, they have the personal freedom to be as good and successful as they can possibly be at whatever they want to do.
Amen.
Yeah. It's fascinating how our founding fathers, and I know there's an element in our country today that refer to them as a bunch of old men and slaveholders and people that you know, lived in a whole other time and had no concept of how the world would change. But if you look at the basics of the founders and the classical educations that they brought to the table, and their knowledge of history, boy, they created a system that was absolutely remarkable. And it still is good today, and it still has the same value today, if it were followed, that it had the day that they founded the country.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
It's
well, Eric, talk to me a little bit about some of the firefighters and folks that you're working with, and how they're starting to work together to make some of these things happen. And I want to emphasize the fact that so many of the firefighters and emergency workers And certainly local police are some of the most patriotic people I've ever met, and why we need to support them and help them to see the reality of the world as it really is.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, a lot of it is, I think the more, and your listeners, it's kind of like preaching to the choir, but the more people are willing to look at this, you know, open their eyes and really see it, the safer it will be for, you know, not just firefighters, but those insiders that have more information, that they're in a dangerous spot to come out with what they know, you know, with what they know. They need more of the American people's support. And so I know with if you go to our website, thefirefightersfromislandandtruth.org, you'll see the top documentary we have on there is called Calling Out Bravo 7. That was made by a small group of firefighters, but one of them, the one who kind of is the lead on that, is in a high-ranking position. So he hasn't publicly announced, doesn't want it announced who he was, but he was very careful in what he did. But he's been very strategic. So he and I have talked, you know, we've kind of been coordinating quite a bit over the last few years, and he's pretty in alignment with what we're talking about. And that we, you know, that it's a lot slower, I guess would be what my point is, than I wanted it to be. But they're, I'd say the ones who really are making a difference now from the inside, they're very wise, like they've learned the harder lessons, and they're making strategic slow steps to kind of get to where this can come out on a larger scale. And so where he focused was on fire tactics and high-rise firefighting, saying, okay, if we're going to believe, and basically that those buildings came down from fire, we need to radically change everything. And that's the focus he's been having. And so what he learned when he went that approach, that's what his eye-opener was for 9/11. And once he did that, that's when he realized, I need to make a movie about it. And that was what Calling Out Bravo 7 is. So it's a great one to see if you haven't seen it.
It is. And as a matter of fact, I want to give you the last couple of minutes here because we're rapidly running out of time. But I'd like to have you talk about the videos that you've done with Richard Gage and what you're working on yourself, and then give people websites and information so that they can find out more about you and your organization.
Perfect. Yeah, so what I started years ago, like I mentioned, is Firefighters for 9/11 Truth. I now call it For Truth and Unity. That's bringing in the unit of justice element. The movie's on there. If you go to that website, you can see it, Calling Out Bravo 7. Richard and I did a couple different talks together and documentaries. One is called Firefighters, Architects, and Engineers Expose 9/11 Myths. I was also on there with some 9/11 Explosive Evidence Experts Speak Out. And the work I'm doing now, if your listeners are interested at all, we're just grounding. We've got a design team coming together for what I talked about, a new model that basically brings in the essence of the founding fathers, putting the individual first. You know, I know a lot, most Americans don't know we're a republic, not a democracy. And mm-hmm. So taking in those elements and creating local models that actually can provide for the needs of the people in a different way, not from a top-down, not from a tax, you know, forced tax position, but how do we as individuals step up as businesses also and really start providing what's needed in a community without being forced to do it by tax. And so if people are interested in that, if that is called One Corps, and you can go to, just like Peace Corps, onecorps.us, so onecorps.us. And right now it's just a landing page, but if people are interested and want to kind of learn more as that progresses, it's happening here in Colorado in the Front Range region, and there's an incredible group of organizations that are holding what I call key infrastructure pieces for a new model that incorporates, you know, what the best of what we know. And that's happening, our first gathering, or not first, but our design team gathering is in March, and then we'll be moving on from there. So if you want to stay in the loop on that, that's where I would suggest is onecorps.us.
Okay, good. And you are located out of the Front Range in Colorado?
That's where I am now. So I was in Seattle for almost 20 years before I moved here, and I was just called, and it became clear I was supposed to be here, and mm-hmm. moved here last year.
Okay, good, good. Well, let me ask you, and we've got just less than a minute left, but what would you tell our listeners are the most important thing that they can be doing to ensure that our children and our grandchildren get to grow up in a country that's free and safe?
I would say my path has been look in the mirror. If we're going to change this, we have to change it from the inside out. And really looking at this is not a blaming anyone else and seeing what is my responsibility in this and kind of getting a relationship with my own shortcomings and healing those and moving forward from there and, you know, doing what you're doing, praying and just really just coming from that place of love and with ourselves and each other.
Well, I think that's excellent message, and I think it's very timely because we are at a stage right now, I believe, with what's going on with the Trump administration and all the horribly divisive, nasty things that they're trying to do to eliminate really President Trump and his message and his trying to free this country. And all I can say is that I hope that they are totally unsuccessful, and I see that we are winning the battle, or they wouldn't be nearly as vicious as they are. So, Eric, thank you very much for being our guest tonight, and I wish you the very best, and hope that we can have you back on sometime soon. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the message tonight. And with that, turn the show back over to you, Kelby, and good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's show with Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. God bless. Good night. We'll see you next Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific.